This is On Being's Unheard Cuts. I'm Krista Tippett. You're listening to my unedited conversation with Mustafa Akyol. He's a Turkish political commentator and author of the book Islam Without Extremes, A Muslim Case for Liberty. I spoke with him on June 12, 2012, in his apartment in Istanbul, Turkey. Download the MP3 of the produced show with Mustafa Akyol at onbeing.org.
Did you find something to eat?
I'm okay. I got some water. Where are we?
This is Ria, my daughter.
Okay, well, this is Ria.
Where are we?
Can I serve you guys something? Like, we had water.
I'll have some water.
Water? Good.
Why don't you...
Where do you want me to
talk about?
Should I turn on some seat for now?
Yeah. And then we'll turn it off when we get rolling.
So thanks for finding me.
Yeah.
My pleasure. I'm really glad to be here.
No, same here. Is this your first time?
It is, yeah.
Okay.
But I'm coming back.
Yeah,
I already know. I just got here yesterday.
Where are you staying?
We're staying at a small hotel. What's it called?
Sadi Konak in Sultanahmet. Right next to
the tourist area.
Yeah. This trip originally got planned because Bartholomew invited me to come help him lead a discussion. It's an environmental summit.
Yeah, I know, the Hulking.
Yeah. So that.
I was supposed to go there, but.
You were supposed to go?
I was supposed to go there, but I had to skip because of some other engagements.
Yeah.
I'm flying to the US tomorrow. So.
I know. And then they scheduled it, and then the Rio summit dates were set. And so some people are having to fly straight from Hulking to Rio, which sounds like really bad jet lag to me. Can you imagine? I mean, Jane Goodall, who lives in wherever she lives, flying to Istanbul and then or Africa. Yeah, or she could live in California.
I'll give you some not cold, but warm water.
Okay, it's really nice here.
By the way, should I wear something a little more decent?
No, I mean, you look fine. Relax.
Like you will show everything, like the trousers.
No, it'll be from here up.
Huh?
It'll be from here up.
Just from here.
Yeah, from here.
Still,
so
I'm sure it's a little nicer than
if you.
No.
I'll be back in a minute.
Look, I'm not dressed up.
If you show up in that suit.
I know this isn't. Is this one I got? No.
No, it's mine.
Someone else.
Yeah.
They all look similar.
Okay. Have you seen this? This is a pretty famous painting. I've seen a lot of duplicates of it. It's just a magnet.
It's what?
It's just a magnet with iron fillings around
oh.
it. But it looks a lot like
oh.
the Kaaba with the pilgrims.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's very cool. Chris, I am going
to
have him say his name for me at the beginning. I'm going to write it down right now. Say your name.
That's probably going to be a chair that cranks.
Yeah.
Like this one here. Let's see if we can find the seat for you.
Can you over here?
Hey, Chris, do you have some adapters, just the plug adapter? Because
yes.
I can,
yes.
You know, my computing stuff will just need an adapter, but it's all running out of juice.
Yep, absolutely.
I don't think I've done an interview in bare feet since Thich Nhat Hanh, which is a pretty good credential.
I think this looks more civilized.
It looks very civilized.
But I thought you were going to problematize the whole concept of civilized for us.
That's right.
Well, I'm trying to do my best. Globally.
Whatever it fits. This used to be a little higher. No, whatever. Yeah.
You've gotten taller.
Yeah.
So I'll tell you what we want to do is, well, how close are we? I don't want to talk too much until we're...
Well, it's not how
we're going to feel. About 2 minutes.
2 minutes, all right.
2 minutes.
All right, then I'll wait until we're really rolling, because I don't want you to say anything profound and we haven't captured it.
Nothing profound?
Don't be interesting.
Not yet.
Yeah, whatever
not
I say
yet.
Is so profound.
Save
that,
your profundity. Yeah. So you go to the States a lot, sounds like.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I go on book tours now for 20 days, 11 cities, sort of the last one. From Miami to San Francisco to Oklahoma to Kansas. Like, it's a huge thing. You see my book?
I have it, yeah.
Okay.
So I don't do book interviews, but we'll obviously tell people about the book. And
that'll be great. Yeah. Tell people to buy the book.
Okay, please. Well, I can't do that, but I'll tell them. You know, I have a book.
Have you taken a look at the book? Yes.
I've taken a look at a lot of things you've done. Yeah,
okay, that's great.
I actually looked at interviews you've given and lots of pieces you've written. I looked at a lot of your journalism.
Okay, that's great. I'm honored.
What was I going to... Well, this is what journalists should do, isn't it? But I know they don't often. There's a book that I wrote that came out of my interviews with scientists. It's been translated and published in Turkey. So we have all these Turkish Twitter followers.
Okay.
Einstein's God.
Einstein's God?
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, it's a small publisher, I think. It's a small
Okay, I've probably heard that book.
But I haven't been on book tour yet.
Like, God doesn't throw dice and from that kind of line?
Yeah, but actually that one is,
he was
that's
deistic,
the one everybody
right?
knows, but it, that one was, that was actually not a theological statement.
Yeah, he was,
he was
just saying their universe had.
He had what he called a cosmic religious sensibility. It's not all about Einstein. It's with other physicists and other scientists as well. But he actually had a pretty interesting spiritual sensibility.
He was not a theist in the classical sense.
No, he was not.
He was not an atheist either, I think.
No, that's right.
Yeah, and pantheistic of some sort? I don't know.
He
believed in some principle, organizing
about,
principle
yeah,
or something.
Yeah, so he
like
talked
that.
About the mind behind the universe, the intelligence behind the universe. He would never have called it God.
Okay.
And he didn't, I think, he had such a reverence for the laws of physics
that
it was hard for him to imagine a personal God who would meddle with them.
Okay.
And yet he...
But laws
I think
of physics
was,
can make you believe in God very strong. You know?
Yeah, and so I think it was still hard for him to say there was no intelligence behind it.
Okay.
But he just didn't feel a need to nail it down, which is the move a lot of scientists make.
He covered all bases.
Yeah, that's right. So should we kind of start? Okay.
Sure.
Turn off the AC.
Would it be okay?
The AC turn offer is probably somewhere there.
Right next to his laptop.
Okay.
It will not get nearly as hot in here as the last time.
Yeah,
hopefully.
I know. Yeah. Look at how my hair curls anymore.
Where were you before me? Oh, let me.
We were with Jamal Noor.
Oh, the
Jamal Noor, the spiritual
the Sufi
leader.
Lady.
Yes, the Sufi lady.
She's interesting. She's interesting.
Very interesting. Yeah, and Omid is knows her, and so he was part of the. Her English is actually really excellent, but we also had a translator. Just occasionally, she would need to translate.
She has a chair in Oxford or something now. Like they,
she's creating one, right?
Yeah, something like
it's
that.
Just a sort of process of doing the fundraising.
Okay.
They've done two so far: one in the States and one in Beijing.
No.
And then the Oxford one. Is the next one.
I think she's just this. California Sufi, as I call it, you know, from California Buddhism.
California Buddhism?
You know that term, California Buddhists?
Uh-uh.
Like, not Buddhist in a very traditional sense, but Buddhist in a very light way.
Oh.
And I think she has a Sufi, I mean, people who follow him, that kind of, which is okay, like totally fine.
I think she's the real deal.
She's a real deal?
Yeah.
At least some people, like I know. I mean, I know some people who are following her thing, but they're kind of partiers and you know, that sort of, not classical Sufi in a shrine. Like there's some people. Which is all good. I mean, I like, and I think in Turkey, this culture war has made the conservatives very politically obsessed.
Mm-hmm.
And
okay, well, don't say anything now. Let's get there. Get there. So the I started this show. It became a weekly national show on public radio in 2003.
That's
and
great.
The point was that I felt that there was a black hole in American media where you took religion seriously, and not just as a political voice, but as in terms of the spiritual and intellectual content of traditions. And so that's what it's been about.
Yeah. That's great.
So what I really want to get at with you, that I think you're very great at writing about and talking about, is really pull back the lens and give people some context for thinking about Turkey's place in the world and Islam in Turkey and, you know, Islam and democracy as it's emerging here. And so so really start with that big context of the Ottoman Empire. I mean, I think for Americans, a lot of this is, you know, maybe they know the words, but they don't really know that. They don't really know.
Okay.
So a little bit about that
as
the context for what's happening now, also as the history for what's happening now. And I also want to weave in that, you know, your personal experience and your family and political and religious story kind of as a microcosm of some of this, too. So we'll just organically weave those things. But I do want to start with, you know, the fact that what we now call the Middle East was, you know, once part of this empire that was one of the largest and longest empires in history, 600 years, the Ottoman Empire. And here we are, this place that was the center of it.
And what do I think about that?
I mean, that still matters. And maybe it matters in a new way now.
Mm-hmm. For sure. What we call the Middle East today was the Ottoman Empire until the 20th century. And as a Turk, I'm not saying this only with a sense of pride or nationalist ethos. I'm saying this also as a historical basis for reform, democracy, and change in this region. Because one little thing that is little noticed about the Ottoman Empire in this part of the world or in the West is that the Ottoman Empire had a very long and interesting and phenomenal period of modernization. I mean, when the empire collapsed, it was not this medieval monarchy where the sultans rules. It had become a constitutional monarchy with a parliament, an elected parliament. It had Jewish and Christian members in that parliament. Laws were introduced which gave more rights for women. Jews and Christians of the empire had become equal citizens, which is still not the case in some countries in the Middle East, like Saudi Arabia for sure. And the Ottoman elite, the statesmen of the empire and the intellectuals, had discussed these issues. For example, the synthesis between Islam and democracy, which is now being debated again in the first decade of the 21st century, it was discussed by Ottoman scholars, and it was Ottoman intellectual Namık Kemal, who I quote in the beginning of my book, who said, well, democracy actually corresponds to the Islamic idea of consultation, and the Western principle of freedom, liberty, these actually come from the roots of our religion, the idea of individual rights.
Yeah, you've also talked a lot about how there's a great emphasis placed on individual responsibility, which is compatible with the democratic ideal.
Definitely, definitely. I think if you don't have a strong base of political liberalism, your democracy will be also troubled. Because right now in the Middle East there is democratization, but I also see the difference between a liberal democracy and an illiberal democracy where, you know, individual liberties are not secured. And even Turkey is still struggling with those nuances. And I'm sure those problems are there in Tunisia and Egypt especially right now these days. But the Ottoman effort of modernization in the late 19th century, called the Tanzimat, the reorganization period, in which the Islamic Caliphate, the most authoritative Islamic institution on earth, really tried to incorporate some of the systems and ideas that we call Western. And these are liberal Western ideas.
Yes.
Because from the West, we also had some bad ideas coming to this part of the world, like fascism, or the idea of a single party state, which still dominates Syria, for example. So not everything that came from the West is great, you know, to this part of the world. But I think liberal democracy is the better side of the Western modernity, in my point of view. And the Ottomans tried to incorporate that in late 19th and early 20th century. And I think the struggle there is very valuable because it shows that democracy has some local roots in this part of the world.
So that's an important piece of this history that you draw on now.
Well, sort of. I mean, in my book, Islam Without Extremes, I go back to the earliest centuries of Islam and show some of the early discussions, theological discussions, which would help us today to mm-hmm. nurture some liberal ideas. Mm-hmm. But I also focus on Ottoman reformers of the 19th century and show how they addressed tough questions like apostasy, you know, right. because apostasy, which is like changing your religion from another religion, which should be, of course, free, is banned in classical Islamic law. But if you go back to the origins of it, you see that it was banned out of a political consideration. It was seen as changing your side in battle. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, the Ottomans realized this, and they, you know, set apostasy free. So it became possible in late Ottoman Empire to become a Christian if you're a Muslim. Or there were even open atheists in the Ottoman Empire who were advancing philosophies of some atheist European thinkers. Mm. And Ottoman Islamic scholars did not behead them or did not stone them. They wrote books criticizing their philosophy and advancing the Islamic philosophy. So I think that sort of open debate and discussion is what we really need in the Middle East. And the people who think that it is never unheard of in this part of the world are wrong.
Okay.
There are liberal trends in the Middle East, and there are, of course, very authoritarian and tyrannical trends too, and they have struggled throughout centuries. And in my book, I'm trying to show all these different colors in mm-hmm. the history of what I call Islamdom.
So modern Turkey, what we would think of as modern Turkey, was born after World War I. And then there was what is referred to as the secular revolution of Mustafa mm-hmm. Kemal Atatürk. You would have grown up in that world. You would have been born into that world. I'm curious about this because Atatürk clearly, I mean, just having been here a couple of days, is still such an important figure.
Oh, cult of personality. Right? Totally.
Yeah. So what was it like? How did you think of Atatürk and the Turkish identity, which at that point was secular, growing up here?
Great question. First of all, I should say, I think secularism is a bit overrated. because secularism, in the sense of cleansing religion from the public square, especially in the French way, is not a guarantee for either democracy or liberalism. I mean, we have had many secular tyrants in this part of the world. Mm-hmm. The regime, even if you actually compare, for example, late Ottoman Empire to Republican Turkey, you can find that Christians of the late Ottoman Empire were more free than the Christians of Republican Turkey, which was a secular
right.
republic.
Mm-hmm.
Because with secularism came also nationalism. Mm-hmm. Which was a much less tolerant force than the classical Islamic ideas of, you know, different faiths and the people of the book, you know, as Islamic tradition calls Christians and Jews, for example. Mm-hmm. I believe in principle in a secular state. I think it's a good idea to have a state which is not defined by religion. Mm-hmm. But if that state is defined by some other philosophy than religion, such as Marxism, Leninism, as we saw throughout the Cold War, or fascism, then that can be an even worse example. So.
And was there a religion in your family? Your grandfather, I've read, was...
My grandparents were very pious mm-hmm. Muslims. And I think from them I got my first crash course into Islam, as I would call it. I learned the basics of my religion from my grandfather. And actually there's even a story in my book I relate that one day in my grandfather's library I found the book which had very inspiring quotes from mm-hmm. the Quran about creation and human beings and life. But also a quote, not from the Quran, but from an old Islamic book, which said, if your children do not start to pray at the age of 10, then beat them up. I read that at the age of 9, and it was a test. Actually, that was probably the beginning of my struggle with this authoritarian element within Islamic law and tradition, and how can we reform them, and how can we face them as believers, as believers of Islam. But yes, my family was religious. My grandparents were very religious. My parents were like reasonably religious too, in a common Turkish sense. But I think one thing I learned from my parents, especially my father, is a stance against tyranny. Mm-hmm. Because my father, like almost every politician and intellectual in the 1980s, were imprisoned by the military junta in 1980 for nothing. Mm-hmm. And I saw
Your
him
father
be armed.
Was an intellectual.
He was an intellectual. He was mm-hmm. a writer. He was also a politician. So the military junta arrested some 600,000 people, and many people were tortured in 1980. That was the most brutal military coup Turkey had. Mm-hmm. And I, at the age of 8, saw my father behind the barbed-wired corridor in this military barracks, which looked like a Soviet gulag. And that day I said, well, probably in my mind, I mean, tyranny is evil. Like imprisoning people for their ideas, for their beliefs is wrong. So in my upbringing, I've also seen that, well, I respect and I actually like the U.S. idea of a secular state in the sense of separation between church and state, which also protects religion as well, not just the state.
Right. I mean, you've made the point that that secularism, as it was embodied in the Turkish government, was secularist, and that it was not modeled on. It was modeled on the French idea of freedom from religion, and not the American idea of separation of church and state, a secular state in which religions are free.
Totally. I think one of the biggest tragedies of the Muslim world in the 20th century, the Islamic Middle East, is that it never experienced a liberal republic like it is in the United States. The so-called modern secular republics in this part of the world were always one-party states, like the Kemalist system in Turkey, or the Nasser's and the Mubarak's of Egypt, or the Ben Ali of Tunisia. And so the alternative quickly became the Islamic radicals, which resisted these secular authoritarian regimes. Yeah. So the Middle East was haunted between these secular authoritarians versus Islamic authoritarians. And the middle ground, it's a political system of pluralism, and call it liberal democracy, was hardly experienced. Now, I'm happy that to see that with the Arab Spring, it's for the first time that we see not the sudden emergence of a liberal democracy, for sure, but the first twilight of a would-be liberal era in the Muslim world. In Turkey, if we are lucky for one thing, we are not lucky because we had a secular one-party state. Arabs had that too. We are lucky because we had our first free and fair elections in 1950, and since then, Turkey is a functioning democracy with a lot of laws, with military coups, with still illiberal laws and freedom of speech, but we had more chance to experiment and with a multi-party democratic system. Just Egyptians are trying it just for 6 months right now.
Yeah, it's in its infancy.
It's a new thing for them.
And I want to talk about Turkey and the world right now, but I do want to point out that, so Erdogan, who is the leader now, the prime minister, was mayor of Istanbul. He also went to prison for inciting religious hatred. But it seems that he's undergone, he certainly has undergone also a kind of metamorphosis with the experience of power.
Yeah.
And I also have read you writing about your father having a similar kind of a trajectory, or I don't know what you've said. He was a right-wing intellectual who became liberal but attached to conservative and values. And he now supports Erdogan, is that right?
To some extent. Actually, both my father and I think, can be considered on the center-right tradition of Turkish politics. So both he and I have opposed military coups and against secularist authoritarianism. But he also criticized Islamists of Turkey as well. So he have always defended the basic principles of liberal democracy. And I think both my father and I, in our columns, have defended the AKP in the face of the establishment, which wanted to wipe out the party.
Right.
Like close it down, or like launch a military coup, a judiciary coup, as we call it.
Right, the AKP is Erdogan's party.
AKP is Erdogan's party, for sure. And I think Tayyip Erdogan's party, the AKP, the Justice and Development Party, has had a really great start. I mean, in their first term was a great era in Turkish politics of EU reforms, liberalization, more rights for Kurds and minorities, women, economic boosts, and so on. Their second term was a big struggle between them and the establishment, and I have supported the AKP, Erdogan's party, in the second term too. Mm-hmm. But in the third term, now they have defeated the establishment, now they began to enjoy power, and now they're showing some of the symptoms of the people that they got rid of. So
the symptoms of power, I suppose.
I mean, Lord Acton was very right when he says power corrupts and absolute power corrupts. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I think we see the evidence of that in the AKP right now. Mm-hmm. Perhaps it's a big, it's a sort of disappointment for some people, including me. I still don't see any party which can probably rule Turkey better than the AKP right now. Mm-hmm. But the AKP lost its initial reformist edge. Secondly, Erdogan's personality is it can be an asset, it can be a problem for democracy. It's an asset because he's a very hard, dynamic leader, very, very determined, very willing to do what he sees as right. He's a decider, you know, and to use a term. But also he doesn't like to be criticized. He wants total obedience in his party to his charisma. So he's this man on the fist, man his fist on the table, you know, all the time. And we are seeing the downsides of that, you know, character and that personality, I think, in the AKP's third term. Mm-hmm. The problem with AKP, the Erdogan's party, is not that it's too Islamic, as people have said from the beginning. I think they have made a great example by moving from classical Islamism to what I call a post-Islamist, mm-hmm. more center-right oriented, like economic focus and so on. But I think they're proving to be too Turkish.
Too Turkish, okay.
In the sense that they show all the classical problems of Turkish politics, like nepotism, supporting your own people vis-a-vis the other people, not being very professional, not being very transparent in party affairs. So there are reasons to be disillusioned by the AKP right now to some extent.
Now, it seems to me that you became more religious, or are you more religious than your parents, or more sympathetic towards Islam as a...
I am more theologically inspired than my parents, but my social life can be sometimes even more liberal than my parents. They never dated, like, people. I mean, they married at the age of 22. Mm-hmm. I've lived in a more global world, travel more, and have more international friends and so on.
How did that happen to you? How did you start to become, I like that, theologically inspired?
Well, because I think my parents lived at a time when your identity was very well defined by your family and your upbringing and your culture and your surroundings. Whereas I lived at a time when who we are, what is the right thing in life, what are the purposes of life, became questions that need, you know, more rethinking. And in my final years in high school, I met with religious people, like a religious movement, the Nur tradition in Turkey, mm-hmm. The people who read the books of Said Nursi, an Islamic scholar who died in 1960. And I was inspired by their teaching. And since then, I became very, you know, personally religious. Mm-hmm. But over time, I also decided that I'm not following any particular school of thought or any particular community. That's why I ultimately define myself as a freelance Muslim.
Okay.
But I think my conviction to my faith, my loyalty to the foundations of my faith remains, and I hope it will remain forever.
Mm-hmm. And I sometimes make this analogy, which is very imperfect, but I think it's still useful to talk about. I mean, you've been in the United States a lot.
Yeah.
You know, again, all things being relative and the circumstances are very different, but the U.S. also had a secular period in the latter half of the 20th century, mm-hmm. where elites became very secular and the academy became secular, right? And there was an illusion of government being secular and workplaces being secular. But the truth is that people remained religious. You know, you've seen that bubble up again to the surface, mm-hmm. in some ways that are difficult and in some ways that I think are just, you know, it's just become more apparent. And I wonder, I mean, do you think that's true in Turkey as well? It was a secularist regime and culture officially, but people were still Muslim and now... I mean, you may be a good example of what it looks like when that's that's just open again for people to discover.
There are certainly similarities between American and Turkish societies. In the sense, when you look at the number of people who believe in God, who pray every day, it's actually very similar, Turkish and American societies. Peter Berger, a great U.S. sociologist, once said, U.S. is a country of Indians ruled by an elite of Swedes.
Right, so
Indians being religious people and Swedes are the secular. I, in return, said Turkey is a country of Indians ruled by a group of North Koreans. Like, well, I wish we had Swedes. I mean, at least they were liberal. But North Koreans, they have their own cult of personality and they're very authoritarian so on. So that was the Turkish scene until very recently. So... A bit like the, you know, rise of the Christian right, the moral majority under Reagan and the heartland of America, you know, and defying the elites, the blue America, or, you know, of San Francisco or New York. That sort of feeling is a bit similar to the rise of the Islamic, you know, muscle or the Islamic energy in Turkey. It would have been very bad if this Islamic revival was like in Iran, you know, the dictator being overthrown by another dictator who established now his own dictatorship. You know, Shah had banned the headscarves. Khomeini came and said, now everybody will wear the headscarves because this is his rule.
Yeah. Now,
thank God in Turkey, it didn't happen that way. Thanks to our democratic experience, the Islamic camp gradually incorporated into the system. And although they remain too conservative from a secular point of view, I mean, Erdogan has just launched a new culture war on abortion, for example. Mm-hmm. But these are the things that we see in countries like the United States. I mean, nobody says we should stone women in Turkey. The question is whether abortion should be free or not.
Yeah.
Which is, well, you can have your positions on this, but it's not an unheard of debate in a free, open society.
No, it's not.
So in that sense, I see some parallels between the U.S. and Turkish examples. And I also find U.S. a very important example as a Muslim from this part of the world. Because one thing in the Middle East is that which blocks an evolution to modernity is the idea that if you become modern, you will be a godless, totally secular society. I mean, I have a very conservative Muslim friend. He went to Amsterdam for a few days and he came back and said, we don't want to be like those people. I mean, I respect the Dutch people, but the fact that they're very secular comes to the believers in this part of the world as something they don't want to, like, want to, you know, aspire for. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think in the United States, here is the example of a very devout, pious society in many ways. A very conservative, like, believing society, but it's very modern and very open, and it embraces freedom. And, of course, it has its own debates and struggles on the meaning of all those things. So I've always believed that the United States can be a better source of inspiration of modernity for this part of the world. That is, unfortunately, sometimes blocked by U.S. foreign policy and its implications in this part of the world, so U.S. becomes actually a very unpopular figure because of foreign policy issues. But when we look at societies, I think the U.S. society is one that has appeal for someone who wants to be modern and Muslim at the same time.
Yeah, and some similarities. Do we want to try to turn off the? Can we mute your iPad?
It's not my iPad.
iPad. By the way, mine might be on. It sounds like it's over here.
Yeah. Someone's very popular. It's definitely an Apple product.
My iPad may be on, although it's not, the volume's not on.
And if you have a cell phone.
Thank you for pausing, Krista.
I just.
This is silent.
Say, oh, here's my. I keep looking. We started at 5, right? Good, okay.
Oh, no, me too. Okay.
What time did we start, Chris? Do you know? A little after 5?
We have to redo that now?
No, we're fine. No, we will. We can live.
Just, so I can make sure that it's not.
I can turn it off. Let me just turn it off. Yeah.
One time, Krista accidentally left the BBC running on her iPad in her purse.
What did I do?
During the Grace Lee Boggs interview, we heard, is there a radio on? Is there a radio on? And you had your iPad on.
Well, at least it was the BBC. So, you know, I think this brings us to a place I wanted to get. I mean, it's so interesting being in Turkey now. Also, see, I lived in Germany in the 80s.
Oh, okay. Turks are there a little different.
Well, and it was a whole different world. Yeah. I mean, in every way, it was a whole different world. But, you know, so much of this, of the what people would talk about when they talked about Turkey in the last 10 years was, you know, will they join the EU? Will they not join the EU? And here we are at this moment where... Mm-hmm. Being in the EU is no longer necessarily an enviable thing.
No.
The world around Turkey, I mean, Turkey is in this incredible place on the map. I mean, that's always been true, but I think it's more apparent.
Yeah.
Everything is shifting, right? Clearly, who knows what will happen, certainly in the near term in Egypt or Tunisia, but it's on the move. And Turkey is right in the center. Right in the middle of all of this transformation. And I do think, you know, Europe is in transformation too. So what an interesting time to be Turkish and to be about the things you think about.
Actually, I'm more proud of Turkey than I have ever been. I'm not proud of everything in Turkey these days. We have still a lot of problems when it comes to freedom of speech. We still have not solved the problems of the minorities, even let alone the majority. So our democracy is still very flawed. I'm not one of those people who said, we've had a miracle and everything became perfect in this country. No.
But there has been
Important reforms. And the fact that these reforms were partly spearheaded by people of an Islamic commitment is, I think, a good example. Mm-hmm. It's a good message. And we are now at a critical juncture, whether Erdogan will... He just today, for example, announced that there will be Kurdish classes in Turkish schools, which is a great reform. But 2 days ago, he was doing something which is totally unacceptable from a liberal point of view. So he has these two sides. I don't know which side will win ultimately. So
it's
we have
too
our
bad,
issues.
You know, American politicians are completely consistent in all things. I'm
so
sorry.
We'll see. We will see where Turkey heads. But I think in the 21st century, Turkey has woken up. For like nine decades, after the Kemalist Revolution, I think Turkey had this idea that, well, we have now nothing to do with the Middle East. We have nothing to do with our Ottoman background, our Muslim identity. Turkey has become what I call a French wannabe nation. Mm-hmm. And, well, there are things to admire about the French society or the European democracies and so on, and you can acquire them, but you cannot replicate them. I mean, Turkey, the attitude of self-denial was, I think, wrong. It caused a lot of pain and trouble in this country. I think Turkey is right now becoming more at peace with its history and identity, the Ottoman background. This doesn't mean we'll establish an empire, some people think. Or this doesn't mean that Turkey is turning its face from the west to east totally.
Right.
But Turkey is just opening up and trying to establish the links that it once had with everybody in this part of the world. And it's the Muslim identity in Turkey, which had been suppressed, is now more proud, more visible, more maybe dominant. But if we can manage to frame this change within democracy and by protecting the rights of the secular citizens and the non-Muslims, this will be a great accomplishment. Because we cannot live in a world where there's big divide between East and West. We cannot live in a world where you have to choose between the free world order. You need countries that will be different, that will be gray and black at the same time.
Different models.
Yeah, they will have their own. So you need democracies with their own cultural tone to it. If Turkey will be an example of Islam and democracy, it will not happen when it's run by a bunch of generals who suppress the pious. Turkey will become an example of Islam and democracy when it's really pious people embrace democratic values and help advancing them. And
it?
I think we have made some progress on
Erdogan,
that.
Erdogan, I wrote down this, you know,
I think Gül is my favorite, honestly, in Turkish politics, and Abdullah Gül, the president.
Sorry, what?
Abdullah Gül, Turkish president, I think he gets the historical and global meaning of this whole saga better than Erdogan, and I think he articulates a more democratic liberal vision of the Muslim identity, honestly. It's also a difference between the personalities of the two people.
So forgive me for not knowing this, but how does it work in Turkey? There's this, the president and the prime minister. Is it similar to European nations where
it
the president's
more of a
statesman?
But the president still has more power than any president in EU countries. There's either a king or a monarch. Or a president, and presidents are generally symbolic. They have little power. Whereas in Turkey, the president too has some power. Mm-hmm. Actually, that's the case because after the 1980 coup, the general Kenan Evren, who launched the coup, made himself the president. So he gave a lot of powers to the president.
Okay.
And the generals always assumed that the next president will be also a former retired general. Mm-hmm. Abdullah could change that, so he became one of the civilian presidents. Oh. Few ones we had. How does he become
president? Is that
he was elected by the parliament. However,
the parliament.
There was a constitutional amendment in 2007. The next president will be elected by popular vote. Hmm. So we will have the first popularly elected president of Turkey in 2014. And apparently Erdogan wants to be that person.
Okay.
He even wants to increase the powers of the presidency even more, maybe having a transition to a French system where presidents like Mr. Sarkozy have the upper hand, although there's still a prime minister and a cabinet.
Right.
We will see. I mean, Erdogan is certainly a political leader who doesn't shy away from political power. He loves to have it more and more.
Well, I mean, here's something he said that sounds like an American politician. When I'm at home, I'm a Muslim.
Could be, yeah.
When I'm at home, I'm a Muslim. When I'm in the office, I work for democracy.
Yeah. Sure, sure. I mean, the thing is, Erdogan wants to be this leader who democratized Turkey and who makes Turkey a world power, who has boosted Turkish economy. And he's accomplished some of these already. Mm-hmm. But how well he understands democracy is a good question. And I think he does. I think his temptation to power sometimes overshadows his commitment to democracy.
And
but
I mean,
it shifts and moves. One day you wake up and you hear a very liberal Erdogan. 2 days later, you wake up and see a very angry Erdogan who doesn't sound like a democratic leader at all. So we will see what happens.
I also think the point you're making is that the evolution and the maturation of Turkish democracy is bigger. Is a bigger question than Erdogan. And
it is. It's also a question of how can we decentralize power, bring a system of checks and balances, and how do we get rid of this political culture which always sees everything in a zero-sum game? I mean, in Turkey, there's a saying, there's a phrase. It says, if you give your hand, you will lose your arm. Mm-hmm. Well, my argument is that if you don't give your hand, you can never have a handshake. So if you don't make concessions on some issues, you will never come to a consensus and agreement. So we still don't have a basic social contract with regards to Kurds,
right,
with regards to the divisions between the secularists and the Islamists. I think on the secularism issue, we have come to a basic live and let live consensus, although cultural wars are going on abortion now on some issues. But I think it's in Turkey, many people accept, the majority accept that if people want to wear a headscarf, let them wear it. If they want to wear a miniskirt, let them wear it. And that's
and
what
that
Turkey
is what
about.
You see here. You see everything all
you
together.
See that, you for see. Sure. And actually, by that example, Turkey is now meaningful for the Arabs.
Yes.
There are many Arab tourists coming to Turkey, and they see huge mosques with a lot of attendance, and they see huge bars with a lot of attendance. Mm-hmm. And that's what Turkey is. And maybe they want to be like this country now.
Yeah. I attended a year ago, 2011, the U.S. Islamic World Forum, which Brookings and were you there this year?
2 weeks ago, yeah.
This was right after. I mean, this was March 2011, April 2011.
Okay.
Everything was fresh, the Arab Spring. And it was very striking to watch one after the other, you know, Egyptians, Tunisians, stand up and talk about Turkey as the model they were looking at. And I felt like the Turkish participants, even themselves, were just beginning to take this in. This new role, this new visibility with all the new possibilities. And I wonder how you think that may, you know, come into there's a fermentation of sorts going on, but how does this new almost responsibility that's been handed to Turkey, you know, how are you taking it in and how might it play into what's happening?
I think among Turkey's conservatives, there is a belief in what I call Turkey's manifest destiny with regards to the American example, in the sense that they believe that Turkey has a historic mission on Earth, Turks as a people. The idea that Turks were the standard bearers of Islamic civilization for centuries after the Abbasids and the initial centuries of the Arabs. And this is not just about leading, though. It's also a lot, making the Islamic civilization meet democracy as well.
Yes.
Because democracy is ultimately, in my book, I argue that the democratic ideals have some Islamic counterparts in Islamic law and in philosophy. But ultimately, democracy is a creation of the modern West. So the Ottomans also began to incorporate democracy in the 19th century. And Turkey, if there's anything that's special about Turkey, we had a longer experience with that. So now, if Turkey can become a country which firmly roots itself in the Islamic civilization, with better ties with the Arabs, and you see that. Mm-hmm. The Turkish think tanks are opening bureaus in Cairo right now. That's great. But also, they keep on being a part of the Western alliance, being a part of the international system, build dialogue between the tough actors in the Middle East, such as Iran and the United States, for example.
Well, and also being
and
literally
also
a bridge to Europe as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Geographically.
So if Turkey can walk this, you know, mutual-like path, it will be a more and more inspiring figure. But this is also, I mean, whether we'll be able to do this or not, we'll see. I mean, Turkey still lacks a lot of intellectual background. I mean, very few people in Turkey speak Arabic. Because we've been cut off from the Arab world. I mean, we don't speak Arabic. Arabs don't speak Turkish. These are very different languages.
Right, right.
We even don't know the alphabet.
It's not like Egypt, which lost its language to Arabic, right? There is no
the
Egyptian.
Barbara, I mean, North African.
Yeah.
But I mean, the thing is, the Ottoman language was written by the Arabic script, and it had a lot of Arabic words, but it was Turkish grammar. Modern Turkey changed the alphabet, it even purged Arabic and Persian words in Turkey to cleanse the language. We had this thing called the language revolution, which is, I think, catastrophic. The number of the Turkish vocabulary shrank because we had to get rid of the Arab and Persian words, mm-hmm. and Turkish language institution, a construct of the new regime, created new dictionaries by artificial words.
This was the Ataturk regime.
The Ataturk regime. Yeah. So the idea was to de-Arabize and de-Persianize mm-hmm. Turkish culture. Now, that looked like progress from some point of view, but I think it was also impoverishment in terms of literature and even thinking, because, I mean, we lost many nuances. Mm-hmm. And of course, the whole society became illiterate overnight when you changed the whole alphabet. Mm-hmm. And today, a Turk on the street cannot read what his grandfather wrote. So there are like some cultural still barriers between Turkey and the Arab world. But the thing is, the new Turkish elite is willing to overcome these challenges.
And, I mean, in a sense, it's an interesting, if you look at it in a great big, with a great big view, it's also a moment for Turkey to reconnect with some of its own best legacy.
Sure, right? definitely. And in Turkey, actually, there are a few narratives. So if you're a Kemalist, your golden age is the age of Ataturk, and you think everything was perfect there, and all your mission is to keep it living. And if you are a conservative, I mean, in the religious conservative, your golden age is the Ottoman Empire, and you connect yourself with the empire all the time. This doesn't mean that you have to run an empire again. You have to occupy countries and establish an empire again. But you look to the world from the eyes of an Ottoman. So what happens in Bosnia becomes very important for you because Bosnians are your Muslim Ottoman brothers. I mean, there are more Bosnian prime ministers Ottoman history than, you know, the ones who were ethnically Turkish, or Arabs in Palestine, or Egypt, or these are Baghdad. When Baghdad, we speak of Baghdad, it's the Ottoman.
Right.
It was the Ottoman governorate until, you know, early 20th century. So that way of looking to the world is more actually open-minded in some sense, because also the secularist vision was very nationalist and isolationist.
Yes.
But I should say that Turkey is not simply moved by a naive, you know, yearning for the Ottoman Empire. Turkey is not big in Africa. The Ottomans never went to like Africa, besides North Africa, because there's a lot of job opportunities. I mean, Turkey is second after China in terms of construction and infrastructure in African countries. There are Turkish schools being opened in all African countries, from South Africa to Kenya. These are the quality schools. A bit like the French or British schools in 19th century opened by the missionaries.
Yeah.
So Turkey has this kind of religious movement which opens schools all around the world and brings some Turkish culture. Turkey, I think, shows a sign of becoming a important player in world politics and culture in the 21st century. And I hope this will be a contribution to the world.
Yeah.
As a Turk, I hope that.
I mean, I was looking at some polls. I mean, first of all, Erdogan received this rapturous welcome in Egypt in 2011. I was looking at some polls that were done in Egypt by an American think tank. If the Egyptians were saying, you know, if there could be one superpower, 41% wanted it to be Turkey. Saudi Arabia got 25%. The U.S. got 5%. What was the other? Very admiring of Erdogan as a leader, and much more admiring of Turkey than, for example, Saudi Arabia. Than in terms of the model of the role Islam should play in society and in politics. But I wonder, I was kind of interested, you've written about the Islamic Calvinists in Turkish, in 1980s Turkey, who were part of the renewal of this place. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just want to ask you we've been circling around this, but, if Turkey is presenting a model for emerging democracies with Islamic populations. Mm-hmm. What are some of the components of that?
First of all, probably I should say, I think there are three models right now in the Middle East. One is Iran, and that's a model of the people who want to fight and establish theocracies and resist Israel in the sense of, destroying Israel. The other one is Saudi Arabian model, which is politically moderate, like willing to have a two-state solution and so on, but religious-wise, very authoritarian. Mm-hmm. Like you have religious police. So, I mean, Saudi Arabia is a model of the Salafis in Egypt, for example. And then there's Turkey now as a new model. I mean, Turkey was irrelevant 10 years ago because it was a secularist country,
right,
which didn't even look to the Middle East, which was run by a cadre of generals who banned the headscarf, who would take Turkey as an example. But the new Turkey is an example. It's an example for those people who want to be loyal to their tradition, their religious values and so on, but also who want to be a part of the modern world, who do not want to be a yes man for Western capitals, but who wants to work with them. So mm-hmm. I think there's an interesting nuance there. So Turkey is the model right now, for example, the Nahda party in Tunisia, which says, well, we are Islamic people, we come from Islamic backgrounds, but we will not establish an Islamic regime. We will, you know, work with the secularists and focus on economic development and reform and modernization and so on and so forth. So in that sense, I think Turkish model, how well the Arabs understand this is a good question, because there is a cultural disconnect. Yeah. And secondly, I should also say that Turkish model cannot be imported. I mean, every country has its own history, right, background. I mean,
so
it would be naive to say that
yeah,
everybody should copy Turkey. But just as an idea that, well, you can be like the Turks in the sense that you can be still visibly and seriously Muslim, but you can focus on economic development. You can work with the West. You can still, you know, have a not very promising, but still not that process with the EU.
Right.
And you can be even a part of NATO, but this doesn't mean that you're betraying your values.
Right.
You can stand for Palestine, but you don't have to oppose Israel's existence. So, because, I mean, mm-hmm. as much as, you know, Turkish government is pro-Palestinian, they're not anti-Israel. I mean, they've criticized Israel strongly, maybe too strongly on some issues, but ultimately they want a two-state solution. So combining all those things, I think, makes Turkey a source of inspiration for the Arab reformists who, with the post-Arab, in the post-Arab or Spring world, mm-hmm. want to have political movements that are respectful to religion, but that are also modern and realistic.
Yeah. I really like this idea of Islamic Calvinists.
Mm-hmm,
Again, okay, there's an echo for me of early American democracy.
Okay.
Where all of the organizations of civil society for a long time were Christian.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The Rotary Clubs, the Chamber yeah. of Commerce, the YMCA, which
is now
just the YMCA, but it was Young Men's Christian Association. And then gradually, over generations, there was a secularization of this.
Islamic Calvinists is a term coined by a European think tank, which European Stability Initiative, which studied conservative businessmen in Turkey, in especially heartland of Turkey, the Midwest of Turkey.
Conservative meaning what? Religiously conservative?
Religiously conservative businessmen who opened up very successful companies. They create refrigerators or TV, or they produce blue jeans and sell to Africa and the Middle East and, you know, four corners of the world. These very successful, economically entrepreneurial, hardworking businessmen. So especially cities like Konya and Kayseri, which are at the very core of Turkey and very religiously very conservative cities, mm-hmm. they found that the businessmen here say Prophet Muhammad was a merchant. So when they look at Prophet Muhammad, they don't see a warrior, but they see a businessman. And they say that, like Prophet Muhammad, we are opening up companies and, you know, making money and using that money for also social goods, for social purposes, like opening up soup kitchens, funding charities, or, you know, like giving scholarships to poor students. Thanks to that initiative in Turkey right now, Turkey has a very large charity sector. And some of that has been politically, you know, recognized by the Gaza flotilla, but that's just one example of that. Turkey also, Turkish NGOs, Turkish charities open up Turkish charities open up wells in Africa or bring medicine to African nations. They open up schools, so they help to tsunami victims. And that is financed mostly by this conservative, religiously conservative mm-hmm. part of the population who believe that helping your neighbor is a godly duty. And that part of the populace is also the voting bloc for the governing party, the AKP of Tayyip Erdogan, because they see in Erdogan a leader who, you know, reflects their values and who helps their business at the same time.
Yes.
Because AKP is also a very business-driven party, and therefore policy is also very much linked with Turkey's financial trade interests. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, that social transformation is also very important. And in my book, Islam Without Extremes, I also show that these Islamic Calvinists are also approaching to their religious traditions, sometimes in a more liberal way than their forefathers. And that also shows how religious attitudes are changing in Turkey, mostly to the positive, mm-hmm. mostly positive from a liberal perspective. Of course, it's a long process, and we still have closed-minded
people. Yeah, they say, I mean, it was a long process in the U.S. as
exactly,
well.
Exactly, exactly. So just like in the United States, where almost every big university was opened by churches, but they gradually became more secular and mainstream institutions, I expect Turkish civil society to create this new dynamic, like as institution. I expect the Turkish civil society to create more dynamic institutions. Mm-hmm. And I see that the very process makes them look at the world from a more liberal, from a more globalist and pragmatic perspective.
Mm-hmm. I'd be curious about, obviously over the last 10 years, I've talked to a lot of people about Islam, like what, you know, this moment in time within Islam. And clearly it's a huge, over a billion people. And there's not one face of Islam, but just from where you sit, and even across your lifetime. I mean, you actually were not raised that religious. You, as you said, are theologically inspired now. I mean, how do you think about what is happening in this moment inside this tradition?
Well, first, let me say that Americans hear about Islam, unfortunately, by looking at or hearing about the most unpleasant elements of the Islamic civilization. And it's just happening the other way around on this part of the world. I mean, in 2010, the most frequently quoted pastor in America in the Turkish press was this gentleman in Florida who wanted to burn the Quran. He did not represent mainstream Christian attitudes, but he was on the news all the time. So there are some very radical Islamic scholars or, you know, imams who are disrespectful to other faiths, and they make the news, although they don't represent the mainstream Muslim position. Having said that, I should acknowledge that, well, Islamic world needs a lot of change. We need change on issues of religious freedom. Islamic world was once a beacon of religious freedom when compared to Catholic medieval Europe.
Yes.
But now it is not. We need reform on women's rights. We need reform on minority rights. We need a more open mind in many issues. But this change will not come when Islamic countries are being occupied by foreign powers, or they will not come when there are secularist dictators which put people in prison for being pious Muslims. Mm-hmm. Actually, those traumas have blocked the way for reform in this part of the Middle East. What we need is change within. What we need is a dynamics of change that will be loyal to Islam, but will be also more pragmatic and rational and open-minded about the world. And that depends on economic change. That depends on raising a middle class. And that depends also on intellectuals and artists and thinkers and community leaders who will be, again, loyal to their faith, but who will also change, who will also ask for change, who will ask for openness for the sake of the faith, not at the expense of the faith.
Right.
In the U.S., sometimes some people become famous. I mean, you see sometimes ex-Muslims who say Islam is a very bad religion, I left it, and
I
and see all the yeah, there are people, mm-hmm. and I respect their stories, although I don't agree with them. Mm-hmm. I mean, and some Westerners think, oh, these are the Muslim reformers. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not possible. I mean, if there will be a Muslim reformer, right. that Muslim reformer should respect Islam
right.
first.
Moderate Islam.
It should
will
be
not
within
be,
Islam
will,
first,
will
and
will
you cannot
faithful.
Expect people who defame Islam to be. Mm-hmm. leading any change in the Islamic world. Sometimes actually they block change, as I said, because it makes people more defensive. Mm-hmm. So I think the Islamic world, the West should help for sure, but...
But you know, that's the question of how to help. I mean, again, this is an imperfect analogy, but it's one I find useful. You know, I often say to American audiences, Islam is 700 years younger than Christianity. And 700 years ago, it was Christians who were waging holy wars yeah. and burning heretics at the stake. And I don't think, you know, it's not right to say, well, Islam needs a reformation like Christianity had a reformation. Islam will evolve as it evolves. But the difference now is that Islam's problems are global problems, right? Mm-hmm, I mean, just, mm-hmm. you know, the fanatics of Islam have global weapons and transportation and communications. So everyone has a stake in it. But I think it's a real question. I think it's a question a lot of Americans would like to ask. So what, you know, what would be the role? And I mean, not just for governments, but for citizens.
First of all, I mean, I think nobody can come from outside and change the minds of Muslims. Actually, if they do that, they will not be helping the situation here. So first of all, I think Westerners, I understand the Western concerns about radical Islam. I have those same concerns.
Yeah. Well, most, and these are understandable. It's Muslims concerns on the front line. It's
yeah, certainly. I mean, and I have concerns about radical Hindus who kill innocent Muslims in India too. So there are radicals everywhere. But in the past two decades, it's Islamic radicals who have targeted the West most of the time. And I understand the concern. But the reaction should not be, oh, there are radicals, so let's go and occupy a few countries and solve the problem. This is wrong. So some people make analogies between Nazi Germany in the 30s and Islamic radicals of today. That's the wrong analogy. We don't have a Nazi Germany example here. We have radicals who are out there, and if you occupy a country, they will go to the next country, and they'll be probably more determined because you've occupied their land and so,
so
on.
So how could Americans support you, even in Turkey? I mean, this emerging democracy
that you describe.
I think if Americans
want to help change in the Muslim world, I think they should avoid military conflicts between Islam and the Western world. They should find a way to solve problems, political problems in the Middle East, such as the Palestinian-Israeli problem. And they should engage culturally. I've seen that, like, confrontations between Islam and the West have always created more radicalism on the side, whereas cultural exchanges, more media, more travel, more scholarships, more peaceful interactions, trade, openness, internet. I mean, we owe the Arab revolutions to Twitter, Facebook, things like that. Thanks to American companies for giving us these tools. We appreciate them.
Right.
But we don't owe it to, like, a liberal Operation Iraqi Freedom or something, which created more. I mean, I'm glad that Saddam Hussein is gone, but I have seen that the Iraq War also created a lot of resentment against America because it was seen as a colonial adventure. I'm not saying it was or not, but it was seen that way by a lot of people in this part of the world. So I think avoiding a confrontational tone and engaging in dialogue, and also economic development is very important in these countries. And I'm not talking about aid here. I'm talking about opening up, allowing the Middle East to develop market economies. It's very important. That's one of the also keys for Turkey's success. We owe Turkey's Islamic Calvinists to Turkey's capitalist free market economy. And unfortunately, the Egyptians don't have that yet.
Right.
So allowing, like, fostering economic change.
They need some Islamic
Calvinists,
the Egyptians.
Yeah, capitalism is a helpful dynamic sometimes. Yeah. And I think we also need those economic ties between this West. Like, let me tell you one thing. When I was growing up, I knew America from Rocky Balboa and Bruce Springsteen. I love
Rocky
them.
Balboa.
Oh, totally. Like, I'm a fan. He still has a poster here. So that idea of American, like, America as a land of freedom that everybody goes and, you know, who becomes who they are. The story of American Muslims that is little known is also important. I mean, I go to America, I see people praying in the middle of New York, and that's great. You know, I'm happy to see that freedom. That freedom should not be curbed, of course, by some Islamophobes in the United States who see every Muslim as a problem. That's one thing. Secondly, America should be seen not through Abu Ghraib prison and tortures and black sites and Guantanamos of the world. I understand how they came to be, but they were wrong, I think, decisions. America should be seen through Rocky Balboa's and Bruce Springsteen's and Little House on the Prairie. I actually even remember that. My grandparents loved watching that. So those parts of American culture, which has universal value, I think should be seen by Muslims. But if you're living in Palestine and all you know about America is that America supports Israel and Israel in return bombs your country, that's a bad image of America.
Another really amazing and fascinating thing about Turkey is, as you say, I mean, you've written that Turkish identity is synonymous with Muslimness, but here we are also in what it was and still is the center of Eastern Orthodox Christianity, 300 million Christians worldwide. We're going to see Bartholomew, the patriarch, later in the week. So Turkey is also an experiment in Muslim-Christian encounter.
Certainly. The Ecumenical Patriarch Bartholomew, the Ecumenical Patriarch Bartholomew, is actually an asset for Turkey. I respect him as a religious leader, Christian leader. I think he's very wise, and he's, I think, very constructive when it comes to religious dialogue and international issues. I have great respect for the institution. Unfortunately, the Ecumenical Patriarchate has been demonized by some Turks in the 20th century, and not because out of Islam most of the time, but out of nationalism. Turkey's political tensions with Greece, which was mostly focused on Cyprus, became a reason in Turkey to persecute or demonize the Greeks within Turkey. Although they were Turkish citizens, many people here perceived them as the fifth column of the neighboring Greece.
Right.
And the fact that Turkish Muslims in Greece did not have full religious freedom became a reason to not give full religious freedom to our Greek citizens, including the Ecumenical Patriarch. So this was a vicious cycle that really traumatized Turkish Christians, partly Jews, in the 20th century. But actually, in the new 21st century, we are moving away from that doomed legacy. And AKP still has a lot of reasons to be criticized for on freedom of speech. One thing that the Erdogan government did was to get rid of some of these limitations on, on Turkish Christians and Jews.
Patriarch Bartholomew has said that he feels more openness with an Islamic government than he did with a secular government.
Exactly. Because, well, Turkey's secularists did not like religion, and religion included Christianity
as well.
It wasn't
just Islam, yeah.
So sometimes you see religious people standing together in the face of an authoritarian secularist regime, and that was the case in Turkey. There has been important Muslim religious leaders in Turkey who have defended the patriarchate or Turkish Jewish community against nationalists who demonize these groups, these minority groups. And I'm happy to see more and more of that. Of course, there are still the steps to be taken. The Halki Seminary,
the seminary still has not been
teaching
opened,
institution reopened. Of the Ecumenical Patriarchate should be opened. Mm-hmm. Why it's not still opened, I don't know. But the problems are coming from Turkey's educational laws. No private education is allowed in Turkey. Everything has to be under state tutelage, including Islamic education and so on. So there are problems coming from there. But Erdogan should do this reform as soon as possible and show to the world that new Turkey, which is more democratic and more Muslim than the past, is also more free. There are some reasons to say, yes, that's the case. There are some still problems which, you know, make that answer not perfect. But my hope is that the Erdogan government will keep on reforming, and those reforms will include reforms that will further help the Christians of Turkey.
Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of fear among secular Turks. The world has changed for them in a very challenging way. And I wonder how you respond to that fear. You know, what is the voice for secular Turks now in this emerging Turkish political
order? Well, secularist Turks, maybe. There are differences between secularist Turks and
secular Turks. Secular or secularist, okay.
There can be secular liberals who think differently from the secularists.
And there can be secular Muslims as well.
Yeah, right. Certainly. Mm-hmm. Well, secularist Turks should need to understand that, well, if they want political power, they should win elections. I mean, until now, they held political power through the military or the judiciary, which protected their ideology in the face of elected governments. That's why they got lazy. They have no vision for the future of Turkey. They don't know how to govern an economy. Turkey's main opposition, which represents the secularist main trend in society, they are still very weak when compared to the party of Tayyip Erdogan, in terms of their economic vision, in terms of their understanding of the world, in terms of their understanding of foreign policy. So they need to learn how to win votes, as the Islamists have done before. And so they need to be more, they need to start to use iPads or computers instead of just, they're actually more backward technologically and globally.
I feel like I don't know enough to ask you the hard questions. Do you think every secularist Turk would agree with that characterization?
Well, I mean,
of them?
It depends. But if you go to CHP, like a bureau, election bureau, and if you go to an AKP election bureau, you will see that the AKP election bureau is much more advanced technologically and in terms of their system of, because these parties were determined to win elections to come to power, whereas the secularists were always in power thanks to the state, the authoritarian state, which reflected their values. Mm-hmm. Now that state is gone, good morning, that's the new world. So now you have to win elections. And actually they're showing some signs of progress, so I'm happy to see that. the CHP is changing some of its old attitudes, trying to look more reformist on some issues. It's a small step for them, but, you know, maybe it will be a bigger step for us.
Okay. I just want to ask you a couple more questions. This we talked about this incredible place of Turkey on the map. It means that Turkey is at the center and can and certainly is poised to be a kind of leader. I also could imagine looking at Turkey on the map with, you know, bordered by, all the places, Iran, Iraq. I mean, where, you know, you're at Europe, you're, that you could say this is an impossible place to be on the map. I mean, do you worry about that? Is it, how can you... How can you move forward with all of that pressing on Turkey?
Sorry, can I take a minute break?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, because my editor right now.
Okay, I'm just with five more minutes. I have one more question after this. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. I'm just making sure that I didn't get 20 calls or something.
Okay.
Do you need some water as well?
Oh yeah, that'll be great. Someone turn this off.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah, I'll answer this.
Just this, yeah, and then just one more question.
Okay. Well, Turkey is certainly in a tough neighborhood. We have our longest border is with Syria, which is certainly the world's not most pleasant country.
Yeah.
The other one is Iran, and there is. Well, the Caucasus, Armenia, and we have a closed border with Armenia, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And there's Azerbaijan and you know, Georgia. It goes on. So these are all countries with deep political problems. The European side used to look nicer.
Right.
Greece was okay until recently, but now Greece is collapsing. So we have issues there. So Turkey is indeed in a very tough neighborhood. But being in a tough neighborhood might be a disadvantage. Or it can be an advantage if you're a country that can influence your neighbors for good. And while we actually were almost doing that, right before the Arab Spring, Turkey had initiated a zero problems with neighbors policy. We had opened borders with Syria and things have improved. We even took some steps with Armenia, which unfortunately did not work. Turkish-Greek relationships became much better than it ever were. The Arab Spring, of course, changed the structure of the political situation in the Middle East. I'm not saying this in a way which is disapproving of the Arab Spring, not at all. But the Syria, the relations between Syria and Turkey became very tense because Turkey stood rightly, in my view, with the opposition against the regime and the tyrannical regime of Bashar Assad. But ultimately, I think Turkey... Ultimately, I think Turkey can turn this dangerous neighborhood into an asset for itself and even help its neighbors. For example, one thing Turkey desperately tries to do is to find a diplomatic solution to the nuclear crisis between Iran and the West.
Right.
Well, we tried. We tried a few times. Mm-hmm. It didn't fully work yet. Mm-hmm. But the talks in Iran...
You think Turkey can become that?
Yeah, the talks in Iran... the talks in Istanbul between Iran and the West was the most fruitful one. And it is Tayyip Erdogan who can have a great meeting with Barack Obama and then next day go to talk to Ayatollah Khamenei and communicate between these two leaders while having their trust, both of them.
Right.
So that's a rare country. So maybe being on the border of Iran can have an advantage in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
We will see. For a long time, Turkey feared anybody that's beyond its borders. When I was in school, we learned that Turkey is a country surrounded by seas from three sides and by enemies from four sides. That was a motto I learned in school. It was the 80s. And Tayyip Erdogan, the prime minister, he said that Turkey is not a country like that anymore. So Turkey is becoming more global-minded, and I welcome that change.
Mm-hmm.
But also we have to be more cautious and sometimes think twice in the way how we act, because we have also seen that Turkish power is not as much as we thought it was in the past few years.
Okay, this is my last question. Okay. So as you personally, as you look at the world and the present, you know, what gives you the most concern and what gives you, what makes you hopeful right now?
When I look at the world, the thing that gives me the biggest concern is the Israeli-Palestinian problem, honestly, because it is. I still see no sign of a two-state solution or any solution. Well, there can be a one-state solution, but I think few people want that. And that question, well, it's been sidelined to some extent by the Arab Spring, and maybe that's good news. But that problem in the Middle East is this engine of radicalization. Every radical Islamic groups begin with talks about Palestine and how it's oppressed and so on. And they might be, and their solution can be totally unacceptable, like destroying Israel. But the very fact that the Palestinians are oppressed makes their rhetoric more acceptable. So I think if the United States can convince Israel to retreat from some of its positions and accept a peace that will be, well, maybe it will give a little bit less land to Israel, but more peace and security, and ultimately give the Arabs a leg to land on, that will be very good for the world, for this region. Mm-hmm. But I'm a little concerned about how that is evolving.
Okay.
I'm also partly concerned about how things will go in Egypt with the Salafis and the Muslim Brotherhood there, and the military still in power to some extent. However, I also know that in Turkey, I mean, nurturing our democracy, which is still flawed, it took a lot of time. So I'm not expecting miracles anyway from the Arab Spring. I basically think that, I mean, Arab Spring is a positive development, and I'm most optimistic about Tunisia. As for Turkey, I hope that Tayyip Erdogan, with all his power, will keep on using this power to reform Turkey's laws, to bring more freedom to Turkey's Kurds, Christians, and minorities and everybody, and not simply to boost his own power for hunger. And that's a threat right now in Turkey. I don't want to be unfair to Erdogan because he has accomplished many reforms, but I can't give him a blank check because I've seen that sometimes he has a tendency to use his power without any restraint. And power, as Lord Acton puts it well, can corrupt. And that's true for everybody, including our prime minister.
Okay. What gives you hope when you look at the Arab world? What are you most excited about in terms of what's good that's happening?
What is, I think, hopeful about the Arab world is that Arabs now believe in change. They believe that the world can change. Well, it can change for the better, for the worse, but it can change because there was this idea that the Arab world is so stagnant that there was this idea that Arabs love dictators, their culture is prone to dictatorship, so they will never change it. Well, this has changed. There was this idea that Islamists will come and cut everybody and, you know, like put women in burqas for sure. Well, there are some Islamists who still believe that, but even they are trying to show that, well, they're not that bad. So I am very happy to see that the Arabs are trying to catch up with the modern world. I mean, when the Soviet Union fell, you know, it took time in the post-Soviet countries to develop democracies. They're still not democracies.
Still,
most of them are.
Still a work in progress.
Just look at Hungary, EU. Like, and even look at Europe, some of these right-wing, almost fascist parties that are becoming very popular in Europe, so much for European, you know, values. So there are problems even in Europe right now in the EU. So it takes time. But the Arabs, I think, have shown in Tunisia, in Egypt, and Libya that they are willing to change, and that change is not for negative. They want freedom, they want democracy for like everybody else. Because there was this, I think, bizarre argument in the West that Arabs don't want freedom, they want dictatorial regimes.
Right.
Well, they had dictatorial regimes because some Western powers were supporting them for a while. That was one reason. So I think it was not a rightful argument. Of course, like, and I think Americans should not forget, like, alcohol was banned in America a century ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I think it was a wrong idea. And ultimately, Americans realized that it breeds nothing but mafia. But even some of the cultural attitudes change in the U.S. Mm-hmm. gradually within the democratic process,
so
with some mistakes
time.
Sometimes and trials and errors. And I think democracies in this part of the world will take some of those roots too. And ultimately, they will learn the lesson that, you know, ultimately what you need is freedom for everybody, justice and freedom for all.
Okay, thank you. You're
thank
released
you.
Now.
My pleasure.
But we
Ms.
are.
Happy?
We're going to be able to make an overview of this.
So oh, yeah, sure.
And my response is sorry. Michael, I guess. Okay, so I guess I'm going to go to the next one. 10 dakika var mı? 10 dakika yok. Tamam, göndereceğim, merak etme. 10-15 dakika.